Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Hope everyone out there is having a great weekend. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here with us now, too. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up? How you doing? We already got people eager to talk to Lizzie. Already, dude.
Yeah, they're all in the chat room.
Great.
we are awaiting her phone call into the show. We're very excited about it. Obviously, Cloverfield is a huge movie. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that.
No, I mean, it's just everything that you've always wanted in a January release, but we're afraid to ask for all the time.
That's just it.
Everything we've always wanted in a January movie, so.
Absolutely. We're going to be joined by Chris later on the show, and just to give you a sense of what the show is, Lizzie Kaplan is here with us, and we will be discussing Cloverfield, and then at the top of the hour, we're going to be doing something over the next month leading up to the Oscars this year. God hoping there is an Oscars this year. Which we'll discuss that too. But we're going to look back at some of the best picture winners throughout the years and try to get a different perspective on some of them. The filmmaking process, what it took to put them together. At the top of the hour, we'll be joined by Muse Small and Louisa Moritz. And those are two female co-stars in Cuckoo's Nest. They played Candy and Rose. And those are voices that we haven't heard from before, you know.
Right.
So it has to be a unique perspective because they were really thrown into this institution environment that these actors had lived in for 3-4 months already. So I'm very much looking forward to that classic film, Cuckoo's Nest, timeless. And then we'll be discussing the Golden Globe Awards tonight. Chris will be joining us, our third Movie Geeks host. So are we all set?
I think we're ready. Let's get this on.
The chat room is abuzz. The number to call is 718-508-9477 if you have any questions for tonight's guests, or you can submit them through the chat room. Jerry is manning it right now. And
If you got questions, and this goes to people in the chat room as well, if you have questions, you can ask me, but feel free to call in at any time.
Absolutely. And, Jerry, I have to give people a fair warning. I'm kind of out of breath. I have to.
Doing, like, the Iron Man competition today?
I know. You know how meticulous I like to be with my interviews. And I really try to prepare. And my computer earlier today crashed on me, and I lost all of my work. So this is going to be a real test of if I can have a conversation without referring to my notes every 2 seconds because I don't have my notes.
But we got tons of people have tons of questions, so
yeah.
I think we should get it on.
Let's get it on. For the past 6 months, the questions have lingered and intensified with film lovers all over the globe. What is Cloverfield, and what exactly can we expect to see on 1-18-08? This Friday, all of our questions will be answered as Cloverfield finally hits theaters. Produced by J.J. Abrams and directed by Matt Reeves, this highly anticipated film features a stellar cast of young talents, including our first guest tonight, Lizzie Kaplan. Ms. Kaplan has been featured in great television series like Smallville, Freaks and Geeks, The Pitts, True Calling, and The Class, and hit the big screen in a big way with her outstanding performance in Mean Girls. It is a great pleasure to welcome Lizzie Kaplan to our show. Lizzie, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
No problem.
How does this feel? This is like we spoke to before. The anticipation is so intense for this movie, and we're 5 days out. What kind of feeling do you have? Are you just waiting for it to get over with? Or
a little bit. I'm a little numb. This is the part that kind of freaks me out more than any of the other parts, like the publicity and trying to get people excited about the movie. And I have to say, though, I think I was the most nervous right after the teaser came out, because that caused everybody to kind of freak out a little bit, and I didn't think we were going to be able to sustain interest for so many months, but they managed to do it, I think, in an effective way. So I've seen the movie a couple times, and I don't know, I think people are going to really dig it.
Okay, hey, can't wait to talk to you about that. But so you guys were actually still in production when the teaser hit?
Yeah, we actually shot that teaser a month before starting actual shooting. And that was, I think, prepped more than the entire film. And so we shot that, and then for the movie we reshot a lot of it, a lot of the party stuff. But yeah, that was like a completely separate entity.
Okay, so that feeling kind of once this teaser hit and people were buzzing all over the place about it, did that feeling kind of permeate the set?
Yes, definitely. We weren't entirely sure. I mean, the way that the movie was made was so unlike anything else that I've worked on, so everybody was confused a lot of the time, and there was a lot of running and a lot of takes and a lot of pandemonium, so I think we were just tired more than excited most of the time.
Right. Yeah, I can understand that. But so tell me how this part came to you. How were you approached? Was this an audition process, or did they just...
There was, but it was an interesting audition process because, as you know, they're very secretive guys, those bad robot boys. And so we went in, and we were given pages, but it seemed like it was sort of like a Reality Bites type show or movie.
Right.
Like just kids trying to get this party together, and they're fighting, and the couple doesn't get along, and it was just a regular seeming film. And so we just did that, and then for the callbacks, we had to be mixed and matched with different actors, and then they just introduced this whole other scene where, so it starts in a, you know, a party, and we're getting ready for this party, and it's kind of just, you know, normal business. And then the second scene, we were in France and plunging each other's hearts with adrenaline needles, and we had no idea what the movie was about. Nobody had a script,
wow.
And nobody would tell us. And then after the audition, they would ask what we thought it was about and just laugh and laugh and laugh at our guesses because most people were so far off. And then we found out that the second audition scene was actually from Alias and had nothing to do with the film.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
All right. So I know that Woody Allen only likes to give his actors their particular scenes, but were you given the entire script at a certain point?
Yes, but after we signed on.
Okay.
We were told a brief synopsis of what the film was going to be about, but we weren't allowed to read the script until we were signed on, and it was the first day of rehearsals. So we were all just kind of clustered around this table, reading it quickly, trying to figure out what this movie was about that we were going to be doing for the next couple months.
You know, there are movies that there are people that say that all stories have basically been told. It's just in the execution of the story that matters, you know, that the particular direction it goes in. Is this movie, does the kind of secrecy and surprise element, is this important for Cloverfield?
I at this point, I think that we're just so used to keeping everything a secret that we're still going with that. But
right.
Yes, I think what people are going to be impressed with is the execution, though, over the actual story, because it is something brand new, execution-wise. And I think that that's, you know, you can't really say that about too many films nowadays, that
yeah.
It's something new. And it really, really is, and I think that we pulled that off.
Well, it kind of gives me a sense of, and you know, you can laugh me off, maybe I'm completely off base, but the teaser gives you a feeling of, kind of like the post 9/11 view that Spielberg had with War of the Worlds,
right?
Something similar to that. Is that on the right path of thinking?
We were actually told to watch a lot of the 9/11 YouTube clips that people took with their cameras,
okay.
And I don't know though. It's not really exploiting 9/11, but I think that there is this. I mean, super unfortunate, obviously, but we do have as a nation like a collective group of images for something like this. If a disaster of this scale were to happen, it wouldn't look unlike 9/11 at times. And I think that, you know, that's obviously a terrible thing that we have those images, but I think that it's very realistic in that during 9/11, everybody had their video cameras out. Everybody was taping everything with their cell phones, and I think we're drawing upon that a lot.
Absolutely, and plus it's something that you know, especially because you shot this in New York, right? New York
we shot actually most of it in L.A. and only about a week and a half, 2 weeks in New York.
Oh, I see, I see. But
you won't be able to tell, I promise.
Okay. We'll hold you to that.
What's that?
We'll hold you to that.
Yeah, seriously. I was amazed. Because half the, like, there's a big Brooklyn Bridge sequence, and half of that was shot actually on the Brooklyn Bridge, and half was shot in some green screen in San Pedro.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, totally amazing. I don't know
how
people do that. I have no idea how any of that is done, even after doing this movie.
Well, the film is shot through the point of view of whoever's holding the video camera. Am I correct in that?
You are correct.
So were the actors actually shooting most of the film, or was it the DP or the camera operators?
We had a few operators that a few got injured, and there was a lot of running around, a lot of heavy equipment falling and constantly. But T.J. Miller, who's one of the actors in the film who plays the cameraman, he shot a fair amount of it, which is pretty cool, and he got really good at it, actually.
Mm. Well, it has to be. You find yourself in... You know, I know that this isn't done at the budget of a Lucas film, but it's obviously a massive kind of undertaking, a massive kind of production with a lot of effects and things
sure.
of that
yeah.
sort. What does that do for you as an actress to kind of place you in that atmosphere?
Well, another thing I'll say is it definitely looks like it costs a lot more than it costs to make.
Yeah,
So it looks like New York and it looks more expensive. Those are the two things I can guarantee. I did a little bit of green screen stuff on the show Smallville, but it was on a much smaller scale. And you just get used to it. You get used to being scared of absolutely nothing, of walking around huge Statue of Liberty heads that aren't actually there. And,
right.
I mean, luckily this movie, I think one of the things that it succeeds in doing is it's primarily about the relationships that these people have and, you know, what happens to these relationships in this time of crisis. And... for that reason, I think most of our acting was focused very heavily on just, you know, legitimate acting stuff. And as far as the running around and screaming, we did a hell of a lot of that. But,
right.
You know, it was mostly about these relationships.
Well, at the same time, when you're dealing with themes like this, more so than most other genres, the performance is kind of set at a fever pitch, you know, and you have to maintain that. That must be challenging.
Yeah, a lot of running, a lot of crying, and that is difficult to maintain, especially because the way that it's shot is it was so specific in the method in which they shot it to make it look like it was, you know, just some guy holding a camera, but everything was very exact, and so we had to do upwards of 50 takes for everything, so... how many times can you really, like, cry your eyes out and scream? And, you know, we had to do it that many times just so the camera would be perfect and catch us, you know, in the corner of the frame instead of right in the middle of the frame. And so a lot of it was kind of figuring out as we went along.
Yeah. With J.J. Abrams, was he kind of a constant presence on the set? Is he very hands-on producer-wise?
He was very hands-on in the auditioning process and explaining what everything was to us. He was around, you know, a handful of times, but they were actually shooting a pilot at the time, and he was directing that, I believe. So as far as the actual direction of it, that was all Matt Reeves.
Mm. And what was he like to work with?
Matt?
Yeah.
He was great. I mean, he had only done, I think his, I don't know if he did more than one other movie, but the one other movie that I knew that he did was The Pallbearer.
Yeah, the David Schwimmer movie, yeah.
With David Schwimmer, and his next movie is literally two people sitting in a room talking to each other. And he, you know, directed a bunch of Felicities and created Felicity with J.J. So this was the first movie of this scale that he had done, as well as most of us actors, except for, I think, Mike Vogel, who did Poseidon and was used to this kind of business. But... so he was running around just as crazy as the rest of us, but he will be an action film director after this movie. I'm pretty positive because he pulled it off. And I think a lot of times, you know, these action directors, they focus so much on the effects and the explosions that they lose a lot of the real character moments. And since he came, I think that they picked him to direct it because he's coming from a place where it's all based on, you know, people sitting in a room talking.
Yeah, and we're seeing right now in our chat room, we had a comment there that said from one of our listeners that they're glad that the movie focuses on relationships, because for all the pyrotechnics and all that kind of stuff, that doesn't, you don't feel anything for that unless you feel for the characters.
Right.
Yeah, and those movies are, they're orchestrated in such a way that the music is swelling and you know when you're supposed to be sad, and there's these huge proclamations like, we're going to get them and we're going to kill it, and there's absolutely none of that in this movie. There's no music. I think that there's legitimately funny parts and legitimately real moments in it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I bet.
Yeah, that's what I think is the main difference, is there is no music. There's no soundtrack for this film, and I think that gives it an edge almost, to give it this like reality feel.
Yeah.
You're seeing this as it's happening. We're seeing this almost like we're there right in the middle of it, and I think that gives it a unique edge to every other movie that's come before it.
Totally. And I get really annoyed with the amount of cheesy music that's in films, because I really hate, in television shows, it's just annoying to me how you really are told when you're supposed to be sad and when you're supposed
that's
to laugh,
right.
And it's like
yeah.
pretty obnoxious. But this, you really don't notice that there's no music, because it's just nonstop.
That being said, it is really, on the one hand, it is also, I would imagine, a cool monster movie. And we have people in the chat room that you've obviously seen it. The creature, whatever we're talking about, that terrorizes all the cast in New York. Does it live up to the buzz? Is it kind of a revolutionary design?
Yeah.
Creature.
It's a brand new thing. Definitely.
Okay.
Brand new, very big, very scary.
Okay, well, I got the geek question out of the way. I couldn't
wait. Yeah, we got that all out of the way. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's a monster movie. You won't be disappointed if you're going to see a monster movie.
We have a question from one of your fans emailed us. We've been flooded with emails. I'll ask one of these questions here. This is from Samantha, and she wants to know, how are you different from your character Marlena Diamond in Cloverfield?
I think that a lot of us in this film, because so much, I mean, it was all scripted, but we were allowed to go off the page a lot, and a lot of the auditioning process was us just messing around and rehearsing and stuff. And so I think there definitely are aspects of myself that you can see in Marlena, but, I mean, I don't know how I personally would react to an enormous monster terrorizing New York City, but I think I could see myself doing the same type of stuff that she does.
Well, you're given, how much of a chance are you given to really establish your character before the chaos begins? It seems like you're pretty much defining your character in the midst of that chaos.
Yeah, one thing that's really, that I thought was, that they pulled off really well was there's this party scene at the beginning, and I think it's like 15 to 20 minutes long. And
okay.
In that 15 to 20 minutes of just, you know, as if some guy at a party had a video camera, you really get to know every single one of these characters and what their relationships are with one another and who likes who and who, you know, who's whose brother and all of that. And they do it all in 15 minutes. And my character actually is not in this group of friends. I was just stopping by the party to say hello, and then I get caught with them. So I think that kind of would be pretty tough.
I think you're about to say another word. You can. This is uncensored radio. You can,
oh, really?
You can say whatever you'd like.
Okay. I was going to say shitty, but
there
I
didn't. There you go. There you go.
That's all right. You can curse all you want on this show.
Wow.
Movie Geeks is a hardcore show.
We have a question. We have a couple of questions actually in the chat room. But
go ahead.
One question that struck me is, how hard is it to act when there's no monster in front of you? Like, I guess the green screen, the blue screen scenes. Is that hard or?
It's not, you know, ideal, but I think that if you can draw upon your own imagination, then you could make it as scary as you want, whereas if it's some strange, like, half-built monster coming at you, that could probably be a little comical. So
right. Maybe
it was beneficial to not actually
right,
see
right.
it.
Was there another question, Jerry?
There is another question. How much were you and the rest of the cast involved on the internet marketing, the viral marketing of the film, all the videos that have been popping up online recently?
Not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, that was not us. Like, I think we have MySpace pages. Yeah, none of that.
Yeah, someone in the chat room brought that up. Yes.
Yeah, I actually saw the MySpace page for my character. And
okay.
That wouldn't be like my MySpace.
Okay. All right.
I want to ask you about some of your upcoming films, because you have some exciting films coming up, and one of them is called Crossing Over.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a stellar cast. This
yeah,
Harrison
no kidding.
Ford and Sean Penn, Ray Liotta. When can we expect to see this film, and what part do you play in it?
I don't know when that's coming out, actually. It's got to be sometime soon. I thought it was supposed to come out last year, but...
Yeah, me too.
I don't know anything. But the I play... It's a series of vignettes, kind of like that movie Crash, but this is focused on the immigration issue.
Right.
And so everybody just has these little storylines that all intersect, sort of, but, you know, people have their own stories. And so I play a Hebrew school teacher who sings a song in Hebrew, which my friends are very much looking forward to.
So were you able to perform opposite any of these great cast members?
I worked with Jim Sturgis, who was the lead in that Across the Universe movie.
Okay, wow, yeah, wow.
Yeah, he's blowing up, and he's a really, really nice guy and a singer, and that's why he was cast in Across the Universe, and I had to sing with him, and I am not a singer, so that
I think
horrible.
Oh, wow. Well, that's you know, actors constantly face their fears and
no
overcome
kidding,
obstacles,
man.
So there you go.
Sing and dance a lot, and I just have to kind of hold my breath and get through it and try not to cry my eyes out.
I'm sure you did great. And this is a big one right here. My Best Friend's Girl.
Yes.
Tell me about this one. This is September it comes out.
Is that when it comes out? See, you know more than I do. yeah, that's a movie with Kate Hudson and Dane Cook and Alec Baldwin and Jason Biggs, and it's a romantic comedy.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. What a cast. What people you're working with now. It's incredible.
I know. It's nice to come in like number 15 on the call sheet when there's some famous people above you. It's not bad.
So are you going to try to, I know you have a premiere Wednesday night, I believe, but are you going to watch some of the regular audience over the weekend when this Cloverfield opens?
Yes, I believe that. Well, we have the premiere on Wednesday, and then we all go to New York to do a bunch of stuff there, and we're planning on going opening night on the 18th somewhere in New York, but one of the local New York cast members will come up with where and when. So that's actually the one that I'm looking forward to the most, seeing it with the real people and not the people that have seen this movie before.
Yeah, the industry, we've talked about this to previous guests. You know, the industry screenings, they're so jaded and they feel like they've seen it all before, but it's really the audience screenings, the regular
it's
audience.
True. And for this film, we had, I think they screened it one time for kids. And other than that, it was all family and friends screenings. Nobody has seen it. Normally they do like a series of test screenings and then, you know, change things. But this was only shown to very specific people. And the time that I saw the movie in its entirety, instead of when there were still cartoon X's bouncing around, there was about 12 people in the audience. So it's not really the same thing.
Oh, wow. But I wish you the best of luck on it. And I cannot thank you enough for being with us tonight.
Thank you, guys.
Anytime in the future, please come back and join us. We'd love to hear whatever is going on in your career, okay?
Thanks,
yes,
and
thank
I'll make
you
sure
very
to
much.
Curse a lot more liberally next time.
Yes. Yes. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Lizzie.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye now. That is Lizzie Kaplan, co-star of Cloverfield, which is one of the most anticipated films of the year. And, yes, that's it.
That's it. That is it. I mean, we're responding to all... Yeah, that's it. Look, she can't answer a lot of these questions, because I think J.J. Abrams would have hunt her down.
She was open about quite a few things.
Yeah, she did really good, and, you know, like we were talking earlier today, you just can't reveal a lot of stuff. You can't.
And plus, how can you verbally reveal some of this anyway? You can say that the creature is revolutionary looking, and you could say it's something you haven't seen before. But people aren't going to be satisfied until they actually see a picture.
That's how you fill seats.
That monster in motion, you know.
That's how you fill a seat today.
And eventually, you know, you just have to experience the movie. And I think we all get a sense of what the movie is, though. You know, and it's going to be a question of, and by all accounts of it, I think it works. It's going to be a question of, does it play off like a gimmick,
yeah,
or do you buy into it? And I think this is a movie that's done so skillfully that you buy into it.
Yeah, I think you just look. You got to admit, this movie sort of, or no, it did. You must admit that the triumph of this film is this trailer shows up before Transformers, and everyone after Transformers is done that night, that preview night especially, goes home and starts looking up info about this movie. That's quite a coup.
Yeah, and that's when marketing really, and I think that's people's worry with the film too, is we're used to marketing kind of overtaking the film.
Yes,
overselling the film, and so that there's no room for when it comes out left except to be disappointed. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I asked, you know, is this secrecy and is this element of surprise, is this essential for the viewing experience of this film? You know, or is it something kind of created outside of the movie just to get buzz going for it?
I think it's like it's a combination of both, but look, you know, like you, I'll be there Friday or whatever, and I'll be wild. But I think the genius of this film so far is that this film hasn't shown up anywhere. Not many people are there revealing, you know, putting out spoilers or anything like that. And I think so far we still have till Thursday night is when midnight screenings in some cities, but that. Nothing. I haven't heard of this movie being leaked online or anything yet, and I heard that there are people, they do a tight security check for the screens, like the one that Harry Knowles went to. You know, they gave him a cavity search, I think. I feel sorry for those people that had to do that. But, the security has been very tight.
And you can't afford, you know, sadly, you can't afford not to these days, where there's so much pirating. Can you imagine, if this film leaked, how many millions of people would have seen it by now?
I wouldn't want to be Brad Gray if that's the case. Okay?
It can be catastrophic. It really is taking so much out of the people that provide you with this product. You know.
Yeah, you're right.
Robbing them of that.
Right.
But this is going to be a big movie, and we're really excited about it. We were initially going to take part in the press junket, but. We did take part of a press junket last weekend with Dolph Lundgren, or this past weekend. But press junkets, we would only have about 10 minutes with a talent. We had Michael Stahl David for about 10 minutes the press junket day. But we wanted, you know, to bring you guys a 20-25 minute segment, something a little more substantial. So I'm glad we were able to do that. That wasn't bad. I had no notes. So it went pretty well. It was a nice conversation.
An excellent job. We have 20 fans in the chat room who helped us, and we thank all of you for your questions. And if we didn't ask your questions, we're very sorry. But we do appreciate everything that was asked, and you did a great job, Jamie.
Oh, thank you.
You did, all right? Don't give me that old shucks kind of thing, all right.
In a little bit, we'll be speaking to two cast members of the classic film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Very excited about this. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking, the movie geeks will be talking about the canceled Golden Globes. We already gave our predictions, but one of our predictions was not that it wouldn't take place.
Yeah, I didn't really think of that. Yeah, I thought it would have been resolved, maybe.
I was hoping. I think everyone was. And what's going to happen tonight is going to be very unique. And who knows? Maybe it'll be the first watchable Golden Globe Awards.
Well, it's that, but I think what happens tonight, they're going to be fighting like crazy. They already are, but to make sure this doesn't happen with the Oscars. It will not be good if this happens to the Oscars.
Yeah. Yeah, it really won't be. It won't be good for, you know, this writer strike. Obviously, they're sticking by their guns, and rightfully so.
Yeah,
nothing happens without the writer.
Here's the thing. The guy, I think it was Gil Cates, the one who's in charge of the Oscars, said, look, before when the Iraq War was going on, they didn't know whether they were going to have a show until 3 days before the show. So anything's possible. They're not these. If they get word like the Saturday.
Right.
Before that show goes on, that show is going to go on full blast. So.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Please cover for me while I cough.
Yeah.
You're my co-host. You're supposed to cover for me when
I'm always covering for you.
I know you are. But and that would be catastrophic. You know, what a massive production the Oscars are. And so to hear just a little bit before they're supposed to go on, you know, okay, we'll do it. What a task! I mean, you're seen by millions, you know, upwards of a billion people globally. I don't know the numbers to it, but it's the most watched global telecast, I think, the Oscars every year.
Yeah, it is.
They're just a major production. So I mean, this must put them in a tough spot. But, you know, the writers, they need their due. And I think that the writers that we've spoken to in the previous weeks on the show, they said that everyone basically knows that the writers deserve a cut of what they're asking for.
Right.
You know? They don't think it's without reason. So hopefully they can get this done. I know that they're cutting deals with certain studios and things, and very high profile industry people are getting in the middle of it, and they want to negotiate and kind of act as the liaison between the writers and the guild to kind of get something started. I know Clooney and Hanks have expressed interest in doing that. So,
yeah, I wonder, does Hanks think, I mean, I guess because they both, and Clooney especially, that they'll be nominated, so of course they want it. And also,
I wouldn't be that cynical about it, though. I mean, I think that
I'm not, trying to be. I mean, I am trying to be realistic about it, but I think also the more important thing is, because it is going to be films that are smaller this year that are going to be nominated, let's be honest about that, and it does help for business. So if someone sees that There Will Be Blood is nominated, it's going to give them more of an incentive to see it.
It's a shame. It's been a great year for movies.
Yeah, it has been.
A lot of these movies deserve that global attention, you know, that global stage of the Oscars. They deserve
it. Absolutely.
And so I think that the movies are missing out without an Oscars. I mean, I'm sentimental about Oscars anyway, because since I was a little kid, I just sat and watched the Oscars. And
right, right. No,
was a big dreamer. But
yeah, but it's the smaller films, regardless of what you may think, the smaller films, and that includes a Coen Brothers film too, they are helped. They get a bounce. Everyone gets a bounce from these films. From these awards, and you know, every little bit helps.
Yeah. I believe our two guests are on the line. I don't recognize the area codes from what I was given, but I'm willing to bet these are our two guests. So
okay.
let's get started. I'm excited about this.
So am I.
In the weeks leading up to the Oscars, we're taking a look at some of the previous Best Picture winners, and hopefully gaining new insights and perspectives into the experience of making these classic films. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest swept the Oscars after it was released in 1975, winning Best Actor, Actress, Director, Screenplay, and, of course, Best Picture, the top five. I think it's one of three movies to do that.
That's,
you know, the other two were, Jerry?
Isn't Silence of the Lambs one of them?
Yes, and I believe it was Happened One Night, maybe? Was that the other one?
It might be. We would have to look that up. We'd have to get the intern to look that up for us.
Today we are honored to welcome to the show two female co-stars from this timeless film. Mew Small played Candy in Cuckoo. She's also appeared in a series of seminal television shows like Barney Miller, Quincy, and Heart to Heart, and films like Woody Allen's Sleeper, Thank God It's Friday, Zapped, Puppet Master, and Man on the Moon. And we're also going to be joined by Louisa Moritz, who played Rose in the film. This two-time Clio and Andy Award winner has also contributed to classic television shows from Happy Days to MASH, to The Rockford Files, and she's also been seen in great films like Under the Rainbow, Up in Smoke, and True Confessions. So let me make sure that these are the two lines we have here. Well, we have one here. Louisa Moritz and Muse Small. Is this, let me bring this up real quick. Is this Muse? 541 area code?
Oh!
Hi, 541?
Yeah!
Are you a listener, or are you a guest calling in?
Well, no, I was asked to call this number about the One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest.
Okay, okay. I didn't get confirmation. I got confirmation from the two female co-stars, but what's your name?
My name's Phil Taunton, and I was an extra in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I got a call from somebody regarding this last week.
Oregon Film and Video Commission, yeah. This is what happened. We were trying to track down. I contacted them because Cuckoo was obviously filmed entirely in Oregon, and I contacted the film commission there to find me anyone that was around during that production time, and they got back to me Friday and said that they might have someone, and so I wasn't confirmed, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I must be that someone.
you are that special someone tonight, and we're waiting for two co-stars' phone calls for the film as well. A little bit later, we'll patch them in as soon as they come on. But tell me how you were a teenager when this production took place, weren't you?
Yeah, I was all of a fifth grader, and it was 1975, and I had a chance to be in the movie thanks to our acting Coast Guard chief down here. He got me into it, and. Anyhow, they filmed a segment of it here in Depot Bay, and
the sailboat scene, the boat scene.
Yeah, that's where they come down in the bus, and they get on the boat, the Hayak, and they go offshore and and do some fishing. Then they come back in, and then as the police were waiting for them on the docks, they had a couple of crowd scenes, and I was in one of those.
Oh, wow. So that had to have been exciting. I mean, did you recognize any of the cast at that age, or did you know who you were standing across from?
Well, you know, for a couple of days there again, I think I was all of 12, and Michael Douglas was down here walking around on the waterfront, and Jack Nicholson was down there, and, well, I wanted to be in the movie, but I just didn't have the guts enough to ask him for a job, and so somebody else did it. But I do recognize, you know, like Danny DeVito and that Christopher Lloyd. They were in it, and I remember sitting with them in the commissary, which is our community hall here in Depot Bay, and got to eat lunch with them one day when they were filming that shot of the boat being brought in with the sheriffs waiting for them.
Oh, wow. Do you have any kind of, that must have been fantastic, but do you have any kind of memories or of conversations or of observing what they were doing?
You know, one memory I had was a group of people I was standing with happened to be, they were, let's see, Jack Nicholson, I believe, was in another movie called Chinatown before this one.
Yeah.
And the guy, they knew Jack from there. And they just were traveling through and stopped by and said hi to him and stuff. But they had something to do with production of that movie. And then I just remember, you know, sitting, you know, the 12-year-old sitting there watching all these guys do all this talking and not realizing just, you know, what kind of a movie it was going to be, like you said, with the amount of Academy Awards that they won and everything.
Oh, yeah. And so you've been a resident of you've been from living in Oregon all your life? Or?
Yeah, here in Depot Bay.
Okay. Do you get a sense from the people there? Obviously, this is a timeless movie, and they shot at the Oregon Hospital there as well. They shot the entire film, basically, in there. Do you get a sense of this film's importance and relevance to that region of Oregon?
Well, sure. The place I work at, it's called the Spotting Horn Restaurant here in Depot Bay, and every year we always have people come in, and they'll, you know, look through the windows at the harbor, and they'll always ask, you know, is that boat, the Hayek, still here? And they'll point out, you know, oh, that's where they did this, or that's where we saw that. And so it's like one of those timeless events, you know, it just keeps on going.
So that you actually have people that stop by there to ask about the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's people, you know, like I said, every year there's always quite a few folks that'll, you know, they'll point down at the docks and they'll try to, you know, I think it was over here. No, I think it was over there. And sooner or later somebody has to set them straight.
Tell me about the community there. It seems like it's very kind of quiet and quaint and working class. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. We're just a small fishing community. We're more charter boats now than commercial boats. I think the population is around 1,000 people if everybody's home at the same time. And it's just a real small little town. So
that's a major thing to have a major film production go through.
Oh. I mean. Yeah, you know, but I really don't remember big crowds, you know, like following everybody, trying to get autographs and everything, you know, when those guys were here.
Yeah.
But it was something, though.
Has there ever been a film production, have there been other film productions that have visited through that area in the past 30 years since Cuckoo?
Yeah, there was another one called Sometimes a Great Notion.
Right.
That had Henry Fonda and Paul Newman, and that was filmed just north of us here, about 10 miles on the Sluts River. And then there was another movie that the Hudson Brothers did, a movie called Hysterical.
Okay.
I don't know if that was rated B, C, or D, but but it took place here in the harbor, and they had a boat where they drove around the harbor a little bit, and part of their story. But that was about the extent of our Hollywood connections.
So could you, when you view the movie, can you see yourself in it, in the crowd?
It's one of those where you're watching and you go, right. There! Did you see it?
Right. And, if you blink, you miss it. But
we're glad that they have DVD now, because now you can really stop it on that one special spot and point to the group of people and say, I think it was that one.
Absolutely. You can freeze frame it. I have the DVD here with me now. I've been, you know, it's one of my favorite films, and I watch it several times a year, but I will put on that scene. I would imagine it's when they come back to the harbor and they're taken in, and the crowd that's gathered there.
Right. You'll see it does a couple little group shots, and there's a large group shot, and everybody had, like, dark hats and dark jackets. There's about 4 or 5 people standing together. And
I will definitely look to that. When did you actually see the film yourself, and what were your thoughts about it?
Well, I got to see it when it first came out. My mom and I went to it, And then I think she might have been a little surprised at some of the language in it, and we weren't really. As a 12-year-old, I had some questions exactly like when he's talking to the doctor when he first gets to the hospital.
Right.
And but yeah, it was. I really don't think I understood it as much as I do today. You know, back then watching it, because you're just basically looking at the different scenes in it and stuff like that. Another connection we had here in town was, you might have to help me out on this one, but the big Indian chief?
Will Sampson, yeah.
Will Sampson's, like a blood brother, lives in town here. And anyhow, Dee Dee Taylor, who's Ernie's daughter, is
right.
Anyhow, was Will Sampson's godfather.
Oh, okay.
And so they went up. They'd go up to their house and eat there quite a few times. And so Dee Dee says that she remembers those guys. They drank a lot of beer.
And what a fine Will Sampson was for that film too.
That was one of his first ones, wasn't it?
It was. I think they discovered him for Cuckoo's Nest, and they just said they wanted a big Indian. Obviously, that was what the role called for. And I think it was someone, Mel Lambert Motors, of all people. He sold cars, and he sold cars to the Indian community, and he called Michael Douglas and said, I just sold a car. I got your guy. He's the biggest person I've ever seen in my life.
I believe the man's quite an accomplished artist.
Yes, yes, and I believe he's since passed, but I think he passed right after he did Poltergeist 2, of all films. But
okay.
But he's sorely missed. But, you know, the hospital... there are many employees of the hospital that were used. Obviously, the doctor that counsels McMurphy in the film was the actual head of the unit there at that Oregon hospital. These are community members. Do you have any involvement with them over the years? Have you seen them over the years in the community?
No, nothing like that. Yeah, Salem's about an hour and a half from where we're at.
Okay.
So they don't get over here or vice versa very often. You know, one part of the movie, I don't know if you guys have ever really noticed much, but, you know, when they're out on the boat fishing,
right.
Sometimes when they're trying to put the hooks into the bait.
Right.
And if you look in the background, on some days it'll be nice and calm, and then it'll show somebody else on the, you know, within a few seconds, and you look in the background and you'll see a choppy ocean, you know, where they're filming.
The continuity, yeah.
Right, they're filming a couple different days, you know, or they didn't always have the same kind of weather.
Yeah, I heard that they shot the boat stuff over the course of a week, and that about three or four of them, I think Danny DeVito included, were so seasick that first day, and they had to be dragged onto the boat for the subsequent days. No, we can't do it. You know, they got very ill at those scenes. But sir, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great surprise and a great pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, this is a great honor. Yeah.
And, well, I really appreciate you guys tracking us down and having a chance to tell you about Deeple Bay and what we got to experience here when we had that movie.
Absolutely. You are part of a timeless film that means a lot to so many people, including us, all over the world. And I just thank you so much for your time tonight.
Okay. Well, right, appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much, sir. Bye-bye now.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Well, that was a nice surprise.
That is, yeah.
You know what happens is, I send hundreds of interview requests out, and some, like Lizzie, they came back to me Friday night, and they said, okay, Lizzie can do Sunday. So all of a sudden, the show changes. And then I did get an email from the Oregon State Film Commission saying that, you know, we have someone that might be able to participate. He was 12
right.
When the shooting went on, but I didn't receive anything beyond that, any confirmation. And I did receive confirmation from the two female actresses, actually confirmation from Muse's agent yesterday on the phone, but they have not called in. So
right,
they're going
to call in when we're talking about the Globes.
This is how this works, you know. It's
live radio.
Live radio, tight wire, tight rope.
Yeah.
man, what a great treat to be able to speak
to him. That was cool. I liked hearing that. It reminded me of something, if we have time to go into that.
Yeah.
Oh, my brother, when he went to USC, and actually he made friends with one of his fraternity brothers, Kenny, and one of his brothers was one of the little boys in the movie Giant with James Dean and Rock Hudson.
Oh wow!
And you know the scene with the turkey where they're having a dinner, and they find out they killed Pedro the turkey, and they're all crying. He's one of those kids in the film. you know, and it reminded me of that, you know, these, you know, when you're young, you know, you're in these films, you don't realize what's going on, and they become, you know, of a historical and legendary importance.
It does, and you know, that community there will always be remembered for a cuckoo, you know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It is a time vault movie. I'm trying to type into the chat room, and none of my comments are coming on. Can you see any of my comments?
I haven't seen any of your comments. Lame attempts at communicating lately, but yeah, but not yours.
Anyone out there that has any input, any reminiscences of Cuckoo's Nest or what it means to you, or you want to talk about Cloverfield, or you want to talk about the Golden Globes tonight, tell us your predictions, if nothing else. Just give us a call, 718-508-9477.
Yeah, please call in.
We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
Chris is going to come on in just a little bit. We're going to talk between ourselves, but we'd love to get you guys out there involved.
Yeah,
in this
we
as well.
Really would.
It's a very, surprising turn of events the show has taken.
Yeah, I mean, just the article that you had forwarded me from the Hollywood Reporter, it's now, NBC is, I guess, I'm under the impression that NBC does not want to deal with the Globes next year. This thing is going from a three-hour telecast to basically a one-hour newscast, but with a two-hour, history of the Globes, I guess,
yeah.
Beforehand. It starts at 7. I actually think it starts at 7, or maybe it's 8, but it's Dateline. It's going to be Dateline. But, folks, for those who think it's going to be about Predators and all that, no. This is all about the Globes tonight, so don't even think about that Catch a Predator stuff.
Yeah, hopefully they won't confuse the two.
I hope not. But
yeah, catch Roman Polanski at the Golden Globes.
You went there.
I did go there.
Didn't you? You just couldn't let it go, could you?
I am fearless. We have a call on a 720 area code, and they showed up earlier. Let me pick them up. See if it is a listener in the chat room. 720, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Jamie.
This is Jamie. Yes.
Yeah, hi, Jamie. I talked to you on Friday. My voice is actually back. I just wanted to thank you, kind of off topic, but I wanted to thank you for kind of mentioning my name to Dolph Lundgren
and
everything with that interview.
Sean?
Yeah.
It was my pleasure, man. And
you remember me, right?
I absolutely do. Of course I do.
Okay, cool. You don't understand. I mean, I grew up watching his films. I watched He-Man literally on loop over and over, and the first rated R movie I ever saw in the theaters was Universal Soldier.
Wow.
Really?
So, I followed his career, and, anyway, just to have my name, mentioned while I wasn't able to talk to him, it really did mean a lot, so.
Well, you are a teacher, so you did call, just to let our listeners know, you did call in about 10 minutes prior to the Dolph Lundgren interview on Friday, and I was going to ask your question all along, but it was... I thought it would have been neat if you would have called in the middle of your classroom. and let your students hear you talking to, one of your cinematic icons.
I know. Wouldn't that have been cool? And, the thing is, I mean, granted, he may not be as popular as he was, but, I still follow him. And, I did idolize him as a kid, man. I really did. So, I didn't need to...
I can understand that. I think you expressed that some people are idolize Star Wars, and you are that way with He-Man, with Masters of the Universe, right? And I can completely understand that. And I made it very clear, the Dolph Lundgren interview on Friday was incredibly popular. We've had so many listens to that show since it aired on Friday. It's become a really popular interview. And a lot of people out there love Dolph Lundgren. He came from... the furthest place from movies as you can get. He was a chemical engineering student, and he had a full scholarship to MIT, and he left halfway through because he had a dream of acting. He felt a passion for that kind of emotional expression, and he's been at it 20 plus years. He's still doing it. He's also directing and writing. There's something to be said for that. I mean, he has survived by sheer force of will. You got to admire and respect a person like that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And, I didn't mean to, call in and get you guys totally off topic of what
That's
you had
okay.
planned.
That's all right.
But
anytime somebody calls, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was planning on sending an email, but I thought, you know what, you were real cool with me and, you know, mentioning my name and even mentioning the Denver thing, you know, so.
Right. Well, I'm really happy I could let that happen for you. I'm really happy that you enjoy the show. And if, believe me, it's a pleasure to have you call in and give us compliments. We love that.
We do. We love
yeah.
that.
No, listen, totally. Great show, and I'll be listening to you guys more often.
All right,
thank
great.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Thank
all
you,
right,
Sean. Bye-bye now. Good. It's good to hear from a fan.
Yeah,
this show's looking up.
No, I mean, and you know, Dolph was great in that one with the late Brandon Lee. I like Showdown in Little Tokyo, and I like his take on the Punisher. We used to watch that all the time on cable when it would come on,
mm-hmm.
all the time.
You know, he's one of these guys. It's very easy to make fun of, you know.
He's still in it
from your armchair, you know, but. But these people that criticize don't have a career in film. And for whatever they say about Dolph Lundgren, he is a self-made man. I mean, and he has no problems with getting movies made on his name.
Yeah,
know?
I mean...
He's living his dream.
Yeah,
I respect anybody that lives their dream.
Anyone
you know?
Who can last that long in this business, you have to, you know, my hat's off to them, and especially someone like him, because he's like you said, writing and directing, so he's able to actually do what he wants to do now.
He's very smart. He's a very smart guy, too. And not knowing a lot about him, obviously I read somewhat about him before the interview, but I had seen Missionary Man, which is the latest project he was promoting, and, you know, obviously I had seen Rocky IV. But not knowing a lot about him, I read about him, but I didn't quite know what to expect. But very articulate, very serious and thoughtful about what he does.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and he kind of commands your respect. And it was a very nice, brief, however, conversation. And it can be accessed through the archive. It was our last show. It took place on Friday. The show previous to that, I want to give a shout-out to, because that was very fascinating. We had, talk about a versatile show,
mm-hmm.
we had Robert Stone, the director of Oswald's Ghost, which is this documentary that everyone's talking about. It premieres
on PBS tomorrow night.
Premieres tomorrow night on PBS. It comes out on DVD the next day. It basically dismantles a lot of the conspiracy theories out there about the JFK assassination. Fascinating stuff, featuring the last comprehensive interview with Norman Mailer,
mm-hmm.
one of the great literary minds of the 20th century. And then we did a 180, and we interviewed Christopher Lennertz, who is the composer of Alvin and the Chipmunks, and that could not have been more of a delightful conversation.
It was great.
You know, and that's what strikes me about this show. You know, we never know what opportunities we'll have to speak to certain talent. We hope to talk to people that, and I think most all filmmakers and anyone that assists in the filmmaking process, I think we hope to talk to people that have passion for what they do. That's all I care about. And so far, I would say 98% of the 120-plus guests we've talked to on the show have that passion. And
yeah.
I think that's what moviegoers respond to. That's certainly what we respond
we
to.
We do. And I told you, like, after I heard the interview with Dolph, I was like, I wish he would, you know, he would join us on the show every week, because it was such a great interview.
I told him that. I said, look, man, you got to come back through for a half-hour segment, you know, for at least our half-hour segment, so we have more breathing room and more time to, like, conversate. Because when you're stuck with, like, 15 minutes, first of all, these press junkets, they go on all day.
And
reporters,
he's burned out too. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Reporters are given these EPKs, these press kits, and they base their questions essentially on those. So they're essentially asked the same question over and over and over and over again in 15-minute duration. You know, and I wanted to kind of ask questions that were a little skewed from the normal questions that he'd be asked, or a little different. And I think he responded to that. I think talent responds to that.
Oh,
you know?
I think so. And he did a really good job with it. And like I said, he can. I wish he'd join us every week, because he was a really great interview subject. He did a really good job. And, you know, for people who would, you know, who don't know a lot about him or only know him through Rocky IV, I think it would have been a wake-up call for them. A really eye-opening experience.
I think so, too. Thank you, everyone, for joining us in the chat room tonight. It's great to see everyone in there. If you want to give us a call, Chris is going to join us, the third movie geek, in just a little bit. And he's a breath of fresh air when we have Chris on. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. Whatever we end up talking about, we'll talk some about the Globes, maybe about the Oscars. It would be kind of free form. But if you guys have any topics that you want to discuss, please feel free to call into our show, 718-508-9477. And you've been monitoring the chat room. It looks pretty active.
It's active. I think it was most active when we had Cloverfield, but we everyone's calmed down a little bit. But please, you know, anything you want to talk – well, not anything you want to talk about, I mean, but anything movie-related you want to talk about. You know, no, because I don't want to get – the chat room Wednesday night was insane. I'm not going to repeat some of the stuff that was suggested in there.
Yeah.
I'm just not, okay? I think one of the things we might want to talk about, and maybe Chris will want to chime in too, about the DGA and the WGA the nominations, not about the strikes or the negotiation, but just about their nominations.
Right. Welcome to the chat room, Reverend Wolf, by the way, and everyone that just joined us in the chat room. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. The WGA nominations, I heard some things about it. Our boy from the Camden 28 got nominated.
I'm going to read them to you.
Okay, please, yeah.
I'm going to read them to you right now. I'm at the Film Experience blog, but that's just the first thing that came up. But the first, and by no means least, is Paul Thomas Anderson for There Will Be Blood.
Sure.
The Coen Brothers for No Country for Old Men. Tony Gilroy for Michael Clayton. Sean Penn for Into the Wild. And last, but also by no means least, is Julian Schnabel for The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Okay.
Now, is there anything that you disagree with or agree with there?
Now, what category is that? Is that just best screenplay?
That's just the Directors Guild nominations. That's it. You know, for the Directors Guild, that's just their nominees, which are...
You know, out of all the movies I saw this year, the one that clearly benefits and exists as the writer's voice is Juno.
Right. Now, let me look those up for you. That's the Directors Guild. Let me do the WGA nominations.
Let's talk about those. Let me, in the interim here, let me talk about our future guests. We have some confirmed, including Brian Tyler, the composer of Rambo, the new Rambo film, will be with us on Wednesday.
That's a great show.
Yeah, we'll be. And we're planning on two or three other guests joining us on Wednesday as well, so it'll be a big show, hopefully. And we are also trying our best to get Stallone on the show for Rambo.
We are trying because this is an important film. I mean, important in a fun way, but this is, you know, one of these, he's played two of the most iconic characters in film history.
The history of film, yeah.
Yeah, Rocky Balboa and Rambo.
And it will be a great treat and a pleasure to speak with him on the show. We think this would be a perfect forum for him.
Okay, let me do the right now. I have the Writers Guild.
Okay, let's
nominations.
Do it.
I'm going to go through. There are three different categories, so I'm going to go through those right now. I'm going to start with original screenplay on Diablo Cody for Juno. I'm reading her book, by the way, which is very good. Tony Gilroy for Michael Clayton, Tamara Jenkins for The Savages, Jude Apatow for Knocked Up, Nancy Oliver for Lars and the Real Girl. Those are for original screenplay. For adapted screenplay, the Coen Brothers for No Country for Old Men, Paul Thomas Anderson for There Will Be Blood, Ronald Harwood for The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Sean Penn for Into the Wild, and James Vanderbilt, who we interviewed last week,
excellent,
for Zodiac.
Excellent.
And do you want me to do... I actually think documentary screenplay is worthy, too, because one of them is very important to us, and especially to you, Jamie.
Yeah.
Anthony Giacomi, what is his last name?
Anthony Giacchino.
Giacchino for the Camden 28. And folks,
absolutely.
That probably is one of our biggest accomplishments on the show early on, is that we were able to, Jamie especially, saw this film at the Sarasota Film Festival and was able to alert people, because I would not know about this film otherwise. It was not publicized at any other film festival. Jamie really promoted this film.
It's a wonderful film. I was very moved by it, and he did our second show.
Yeah, I mean, our second show was about this film.
Yeah, it's amazing now that awards time is coming up. I don't see it's wonderful that Zodiac was nominated. I don't see our main man Kelly Masterson in there.
No, that upsets me because, like the Juno, both of those are incredible first screenplays.
Yeah.
And
Kelly Masterson, of course, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead,
yeah,
his career. He did get nominated for an Independent Spirit Award.
Yes, he did. And let's go back to the Directors Guild, because there's some things that our friend Sean Levy on his blog for the Oregonian brought up. You know, with the Directors Guild, Sidney Lumet.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, we're talking about the Directors Guild, dude.
Okay. I'm going to, you know, I'll let you chime in. I just want to finish a point, Chris.
No, go right ahead. I have not yet watched it. So
okay. Sidney Lumet didn't get nominated for Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Joe Wright for Atonement, which is a big, is for what it is a big snub. Atonement didn't get nominated.
Did not, okay.
Tim Burton for Sweeney Todd. These are three, not that I have a problem with anything that was nominated, but these are three that, wow, you're like, uh-oh, the Oscar race has all of a sudden changed.
Well, this is what we're talking about. This is what I'm talking about when I talk about a good year for movies, is that you can pretty much tell by the awards how many people get snubbed, you know?
Yes.
For the most part, if you don't have any arguments with who is nominated, and yet there are still people that are snubbed, that's a pretty robust year for good film. You know, and some of these, obviously, there's not room for them.
That's
but but Directors Guild, who are their directing nominations? It was P.T. Anderson.
P.T. Anderson for There'll Be Blood, the Coen brothers.
Right.
Tony Gilroy for Michael Clayton, which I know a lot of people are surprised by that.
That's a good nominee. That's a good I can't argue with that.
I can't argue with it either. Sean Penn for Into the Wild, which I think is very well deserved.
Right.
And one of them, you know, Julian Schnabel for The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. He just, if you've seen this film, you'll understand why he's up there. There's no mistake about that.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
We can't see that film unless we drive 2 hours, you know.
I'll pay for your ticket, Chris.
Please. You send me.
No, I don't have the money, sadly, but I would.
Oh,
I think you
man.
Would, Chris. I think you would. You would. It's one of these films, and especially a guy. People walked out at the beginning because they thought there was something wrong with the film, actually, because
uh-huh.
It's flickering. The film is flickering deliberately because it's told from the point of view at times of the main character.
Julian Schnabel is a fascinating guy. I'll see the movie just for his involvement.
Yeah, and you really,
really
you should. It's astounding.
You know, Johnny Depp was originally supposed to play that role.
Oh my, that would have been something too.
Matthew Almaric role. That was Johnny Depp's.
He is a fascinating filmmaker, and this is an example of a film that just in the past month has gained such critical momentum, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Right.
Obviously, we heard back from people from Cannes that, you know, this is an amazing film, amazing accomplishment. But in the past month here among the voting establishment and the critical establishment, I mean, they've really taken it under their wing, and that's why it's getting all the praise and the award nominations that you see now. In terms of it connecting with an audience, I mean, they haven't been able to do that yet.
No, it's not an easy film. It's not a film that... None of the, actually, especially this film of all of them, it's a rough film.
Right.
It's not going to be, it's not something you walk.
This is not Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
No, it's not.
It's not going to cross over into mainstream audience.
Yeah, and it's just the subject matter. I mean, it's a hard film from my mom and I to sit through dealing with the subject matter because my father had a massive stroke, and there's a scene in here where it recounts that, and, you know, at times you're tempted to walk out. It's such a hard film to watch, but it's also a brilliant film, but he gets it right. You know, like you said, Jamie, it's a good year when there are so many good films to choose from, and all five of those are good films to choose from.
Yeah, I agree. So Jerry, you saw The Bucket List this week.
Yes, I did.
We were in kind of concurrence on that.
Yeah, it's, you know what's sad about The Bucket List is that you have these two really great actors, and they're in a movie that's, I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to hate it, and you know, I read all these bad reviews beforehand, and I really wanted to go in with an open mind, but the material is beneath them.
It is. It clearly is. And, you know, I just by their involvement, it's not a movie I can hate. You know?
Yeah.
And Rob Reiner is generally such a genial director that you don't hate what he does. It just sits there. You know, you can practically program the commercial breaks. And,
you really know? Can. That's right.
This is becoming a trend, though. Like, really good actors who team up and work on these mediocre projects for mediocre directors. I like Rob Reiner too, but let's be honest. I mean, he's, you know, I love the guy, and he's made some really a couple of good movies. But as a director, he's never really had a distinctive style or broad.
Right, right, right. He, it's just it's touch and go. Either he connects with something.
Yeah.
You know, at the right time, or he doesn't.
He is,
but he's competent. I mean,
he is competent. There's
yeah.
no doubt about that. I actually thought, and I wrote about this earlier, I actually thought they got the wrong Reiner. I thought Carl, because Carl's a little, you know, older, Carl would have been a director maybe, given the subject matter and his humor and his success in the past with Steve Martin and just other things. I thought he might have been able to direct this movie and maybe take it in a different direction besides a schmaltzy kind of thing. But that's just me.
It
but,
is a nice
remember,
movie. It isn't particularly challenging. It isn't at all surprising. But you do have two actors that, while not on their A game, there's a level of comfortability between them.
Yes, there is.
But
there is
I don't see a lot of chemistry. I see that the script, any chemistry that they generate between the two of them is almost in spite of their material.
Right. That's a, that's a good point.
But there are the two powerful moments for me in the film are both generated by Morgan Freeman. And there's a scene in the hospital where his son comes to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's near the beginning. And their kind of ease of communication, an understanding between each other. Then he kisses him on the forehead and he says, you know, your mom does love you, Pop.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I know. But in that reaction that Freeman has, you know there's more there. You know there's like a depth there in that relationship. And the other powerful scene is when Morgan Freeman's in the tub in Nicholson's house.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about, you know, we're married for so long and we have kids and we go through our lives and pretty soon I can't remember the woman I couldn't go anywhere with without holding her hand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's honest stuff, and that's what moved me. And in the grasp of somebody like Morgan Freeman who can express so much with so little, it's powerful.
Yeah.
But you can't recommend a whole film on just, you know, those moments.
No, and I actually think, you know, I thought it, you know what the movie, you know, thinking about the movie kind of reminded me of back in the mid-80s, there's a movie with Clint Eastwood and Burt Reynolds called City Heat.
Right.
And that looked so good from the trailer, you thought the two of these guys at the time getting together, you can't miss. And after the opening scene, the movie misses, and it kind of reminded me of that. But I thought it would have been better had Jack Nicholson acted with Warren Beatty in this film or Morgan Freeman and Clint Eastwood done this film.
Well, if you think about Jack Nicholson, he's never really been known as a kind of, he's kind of like a one, you know, he's like an explosion all of his own. He's never really been the kind of guy who's had chemistry with other people on screen. Like, that's not to say he doesn't work well with other actors.
But you're right. That's a good point.
I think the only time that I can recall, as I'm thinking about it, Terms of Endearment, I think he and Shirley MacLaine really had some good chemistry together. But other than that, even his performance. Yeah, that one, I don't know. I was never crazy about any of the chemistry in Reds, if there is any.
No, I was talking about Something's Gotta Give.
Yeah, again, like, I thought it was good, and they worked well together, but I didn't necessarily fall in love with the chemistry between the two.
Right, okay.
You know, like there was on-screen explosions. Like, you know, there's some famous chemistry that we talk about in movies. You know, like, one that jumps to mind is, like, George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez in Out of Sight. Like,
right, right.
Really amazing chemistry. Or, you know, Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I'm not sure that that's where Nicholson is very strong. I think he's too powerful all on his own to have that.
You're right, Chris. He is a force of nature. He is almost an army of one. And who can pair up with that? You know?
It's hard. It's very hard.
I mean, you can do well against it, but it doesn't. You can never quite be as strong. I think Shirley MacLaine came as close as it's been.
Because,
you don't even
think
in The Fortune with Warren Beatty and Stockard Channing that...
Well, you got a sense with Terms of Endearment that Shirley MacLaine, she wasn't going to put up with any shit.
You definitely didn't.
Yeah, she was a force of nature. You need a very strong personality
to
hold
film,
up against Nicholson.
That, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. But even so, I think that obviously he's one of the actors that are, you can say Jack and you know who you're talking about. He's an amazing presence. And the times that he has kind of, where he's admittedly unjacked himself, kind of try to remove some of that
jacked.
I like
that, unjacked. I like that.
Yeah.
Where
he's jacked off in a sense. I'm thinking about Schmidt, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You realize, you know, not only is he a forceful movie personality for the movies, he's a damn fine actor. I mean, he's a great actor.
It's rare in his career to see that, though. Very few of his performances are like that. It's
mm-hmm.
strange. About Schmidt, Hoffa, I think he accomplished something a little different in that too.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, he did.
I don't see a lot of Jack in. I know it's a movie that came and went, but in the movie Ironweed, and plus the early stuff. I mean, we can look at the early stuff too. Before people really knew his personality and took advantage of it.
Yeah, but the early stuff is where he really comes alive, though.
Yeah, if you look at King of Marvin Gardens, that's an anti-Jack performance.
It's an anti-Jack, but that's where he, or Carnal Knowledge, or...
Yes.
Or The Last Detail.
Yeah, Last Detail. I mean, Last Detail is something else, yeah. We also, I forgot to mention this, we do have confirmed the screenwriter and the director of the new film, The Air I Breathe.
Well, that looks really good.
They're going to come on next week and prior to our tribute to Alan Pakula. And our tribute to Alan Pakula will be 1 hour, and we will hear from his biographer and several producers and screenwriters that have worked with him in the past.
Cool.
So that promises to be a good show, too.
Talk about a life that was cut short.
It really was, and he died at 70. I mean, but you've got a sense that...
He would go on till the very end.
Yes, and the producer that we're talking to next week about Pakula, he considers him his mentor. And let me bring up the email that he wrote to me. A real mentor to this guy, and he wrote Devil's Own for Pakula, and he said that he was my mentor. I wrote two other scripts for him besides The Devil's Own, Friday Night Lights. He was the original director attached to that film.
Right, that's right.
And an adaptation of Jonathan Lethem's film noir sci-fi classic Gun with Occasional Music, which was never produced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That should be some interesting anecdotes.
It's the what could have been, the what ifs with him especially that are, you know, he just can go on and on.
Yeah, incredible director. And he really found a niche, too, with political thrillers. I mean, he did Parallax View, which is phenomenal, and All the President's Men, The Pelican Brief, Presumed Innocent.
Mm-hmm. But those first two you mentioned are just they're like sort of whatever the blueprints for what everyone uses.
Yeah,
I mean, really, what everyone uses when they think of the paranoid thrillers of that time and what you want to make.
Clute, and you talk about somebody that started their career off right, producing To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do much better than that.
I mean, yeah, you could have ended it right there.
Yeah, I mean, you could have stopped the.
Absolutely. So, Chris, are you going to be watching the Globes tonight?
Well, unfortunately, I have to pick up my girlfriend at the airport, so no, I don't think I'll be watching them live. I will be watching it later tonight, but whatever it is, it's still very unsure to me what this is going to be like. I mean, are they going to get Peter Coyote to read this?
No, I think it's going to be, it's not going to be Access Hollywood, but there are going to be a number of people at this, a news conference.
Yeah.
And Mary Hart will be there.
Very strange that this is happening. And they're talking about it a little bit on Shootout today about how it's bizarre that there's some of the Writers Guild is giving waivers to, you know, Letterman and some people like this, but not to the Golden Globes. It's very strange that it's going to go down like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It'll be very interesting to see how it plays. I mean, I'm going to turn it on. I normally watch the Golden Globes just like the Oscars every year, but this year it'll be a real curiosity. Just what is this thing going to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But Chris, I know you're also TiVoing the Terminator series, which is what you're really excited about.
I am. I'm excited about it. I'm also, you know, I'm a little hesitant to get too excited about it, but the fact that there have been so many good network shows in the last couple years, you know, things like 24 and Lost, and, you know, Fox in particular has been pretty good about making some good shows. So I'm interested. I love the
show. So am I.
You know, it's just like if they made an Aliens TV show, I would be interested. You know, I'd know a couple of them. You know, I'd give it a chance.
Oh, I'll give this a chance.
Yeah, I'm pretty interested to see what they're going to do with it. They're sure promoting the shit out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are. If anyone in the chat room has an opinion on The Terminator or you want to call in, just leave some comments or give us a call at 718-508-9477. We're about 10 minutes from wrapping it up, so you got plenty of time. Yeah, the Globes will be something else, but, you know, there's no kind of celebration for the winners. I'm gonna kind of miss that. And Jerry and I were talking before you came on, Chris, about the importance of the Oscars is, if in nothing else, letting the world know about these great films that they might not otherwise know about.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, the Golden Globes is instrumental in that, especially in the last, 10, 15 years, because the Golden Globes really pushes the momentum on some of those films like Million Dollar Baby, things like that, that
mm-hmm.
maybe are not in the public's consciousness, but a lot of people watch the Golden Globes, and they wouldn't normally be exposed to something like Million Dollar Baby until they saw, oh, this Million Dollar Baby movie's winning a bunch of awards at the Globes, what's happening here, I'll go see it, and then the movie gains a bunch of momentum come Oscar time, so that might not happen this year, you might see some of those movies that we're thinking now are going to win actually win, Nothing's not going to change anything.
Yeah, but it helps with I remember when Bugsy came out, and like when Warren Beatty won the Golden Globe for that. You know, it gives a film like that a lot of momentum.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah, it really does. And I'm you watch the Oscars and the Golden Globes, and they are important to the industry. So that's why I kind of have a question mark about why the Writers Guild
shoot themselves in the foot.
Yeah, because it benefits the entire industry, I would think.
It does. It really does. So
which movies in particular this year though will be hurt by the Golden Globes? I'm thinking it's going to be like There Will Be Blood.
Yeah,
right now might be in a place at the Golden Globes to get a lot of momentum, and that might not happen now,
Yeah.
Come Oscar time, it's not going to be in theaters anymore if it doesn't get some momentum right.
Yeah,
now.
You're absolutely right, Chris. That is the first film I thought of.
And Jerry and I were talking about this, too, because we were talking about, and Chris, you said the same thing, we're surprised and delighted that Juno has picked up as it has, and it's really, become a big box office favorite right now, and of course it's a critical favorite too, and we love the film, but we're pleased to see that translate into dollars. But surprisingly, No Country for Old Men, for all of its acclaim, it hasn't picked up to Juno numbers.
No, it hasn't. Maybe that's just the nature of the movie. People right around the holidays, they don't necessarily want to see something that's so heavy and dark, and that movie, while I love it, while it's fantastic and very powerful, it is definitely a dark movie. And
oh, it is.
Sold,
yeah.
It's not. They're not. Pretending that it's something else. So Juno is exactly the opposite. It's a very serious movie, but at the same time, it's lighthearted, and you can enjoy it, and you can walk out of it feeling good.
Right.
How much, Chris, do you think the perception of Joe Schmo coming back from No Country for Old Men and saying it's fine, but the ending sucks? How much do you think that perception has played into its box office performance?
I don't think that plays into it at all, actually. That's the kind of movie that, for me, it seems like people either want to see it, they know who the Coen brothers are, and they want to see it because the Coen brothers are involved, or maybe they read the book, or maybe the movie and the trailer itself and the subject matter appeals to some people if they like Westerns, for instance. But I don't think that word of mouth on that one, because really the people that do see it, the people that did see it, yeah, people might say the ending's a little weird, but I'm not sure I've heard anyone say that the ending sucked.
Yeah, I've only heard one person so far say the ending sucks. That was last night, but...
Yeah. Why? Is that your perception, that is what's causing people are saying, I don't want to see it because I heard the ending was...
I think that a little bit that people have been saying, well, the ending just doesn't... people feel is doesn't go with the rest of the movie, and I think the ending goes beautifully with the rest of the movie.
All three of us are in complete agreement that the ending is the movie. I mean, the ending is No Country for Old Men.
That's what the title means.
A happy ending to the movie, or any other ending, really, I think would be completely inappropriate. The ending is exactly, it seems kind of ambiguous while you're watching it, but after you let it digest it a little bit, think about it.
Makes perfect.
And they really are explaining the movie to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't I can't understand that school of thought that the ending is...
But at the same time, this is what I'm thinking. You and I live in an area, not a bit major metropolitan area. We live in the down home, down south, you know. And this is a kind of a new take on, you know, the old Western. You know, it really is. It's like a modern Western film noir
kind
of thing.
Yes, it is.
Revisionist, like all of the Coen Brothers films are. But yeah. You know, you have an audience of people, the West, Tommy Lee Jones, a sheriff. They're going to see a Tommy Lee Jones movie. They're not necessarily going to get the full-on reasoning behind the ending. They're going to come back and say the ending was terrible. And people have a perception that I don't want to spend 2 hours in a movie if the ending's going to disappoint me.
Yeah.
So I just don't want to see it. And I'm wondering, for all the talk of the ending, if it's had to have some effect worldwide on this.
Yeah, it's possible that it will have an effect. But then again, you know, the movie came out in, what, November? Like you were saying, we live here in Lakeland, Florida, you know, sandwiched
right.
in between Tampa and Orlando. We couldn't even see the movie right now if we wanted to. I don't think it's playing here anymore. It's gone, you know. I'm not even sure if it is playing in Tampa or Orlando, maybe in a couple theaters. It's pretty much...
I don't think it's playing near me.
It's pretty much bowed out at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to be looking for probably a late spring DVD release or something like that. I think if what you're saying is true, then it already has taken effect.
Yeah.
The movie's not going to do any better on DVD than it did in the theater, unfortunately. Because, like, I at this point, I still think it's the best movie of the year. Really powerful.
Yeah, me too. But I do think, though, that DVD pretty much outgrosses theatrical across the board.
Yes.
So I think that whatever promise the Golden Globes or the Oscars hold for No Country is in that realm. It's in the DVD market, which is important. I think that people know that that's a huge basket DVD, and it's a lot more promising than theatrical is. Many
yes, it is.
It's changed the way that I watch movies for sure. You know, 5 years ago, I would go see everything. I was Jerry. You know, I would go see everything.
I have to tell you, both of my brothers make fun of me. They go, "You're a movie publicist's best friend."
Yeah,
yeah,
you really are. And
well,
I don't mean that. I don't mean that as an insult in any sense of the word.
No, I know.
If I had the money and the time, I still would, but I don't have either of those. So what I do now is I say, yeah, I want to see, Alien versus Predator or Enchanted. These are the movies, you know, they're on that second tier. Like, I'm kind of interested in seeing them, but they're not something I'm really excited about. I'll very readily these days say, no, I'm not going to go see that because it'll be on DVD in a couple months. And that's how, you know, most of the country looks at it now.
Yeah, you're right. And I got to tell you, what's even for me, there are some films that I'll even say, I know it's going to be out on DVD in 2 months. I'll wait till then.
Yeah, I mean, why would you? It's so quick, and like, you know, 310 to Yuma, for instance, it's out on DVD. It came out last week. That movie was just in the theaters. We were just talking about that. You know, it seems like a couple shows ago.
Yeah,
the window is so short that
it gets shorter and shorter.
Yeah, and the movie came out. I watched it on DVD. I don't feel like I missed anything seeing it in the theater. I watched it on DVD. I enjoyed it very much.
It's a great film, by the way.
It is a great film. And talk about Westerns, this is the exact opposite of No Country for Old Men. It's a very classic kind of Western.
Tried and true.
Yeah, very, very tried and true type of Western, and enjoyable in the exact same sense that those old John Wayne and, you know, John Ford type movies were.
Yeah, and unlike those, built upon the charisma of the two actors, you know.
Oh, God, incredible.
And Ben Foster, who I hear is amazing in it.
Yeah, Ben Foster's great.
Ben Foster is very good, but I enjoyed him in the movie, but I think he has a tendency to go a shade too far sometimes. I feel that way a little bit. But that said, the praise that he gets for the movie is definitely warranted. He steals a couple scenes.
Talking about event pictures and what people flock to the actual theater to see, on the beginning of Cloverfield, there will be a teaser for Star Trek, which I read an interview with its star, Cloverfield star Michael Saul David, where he said that he's seen the teaser, which shows clips from the film, and he's actually seen scenes from the film, too, in J.J. Abrams' editing suite, and says that, you know, of course he's going to say it, but, you know, I don't doubt him, that it's amazing stuff, that it's going to get people, you know, people are buzzing about Cloverfield. Once they see Cloverfield, they'll be buzzing about Star Trek. My theory is it's a Paramount release Cloverfield. So is Star Trek. I'm thinking Indiana Jones has to be on Cloverfield too.
Yeah, I know.
This is
we
its last.
So many. We thought that so many times recently, though.
Yeah, you thought that about National Treasure.
Yeah, we did. But I agree with you, Jimmy. We talked about it earlier today. It's got to be. Like, they've got a very. I know that it's Indiana Jones. No matter when they start promoting it, it's going to be huge. It doesn't matter. But they really do need to get on the ball.
Yeah, they
need to capitalize on this opportunity. Yeah.
Yeah.
They need to show something.
It's going to be a big movie.
It's got to be, man. I'm giddy about it. I'm like a kid in a candy store. About
yeah,
it.
I mean, once I hear the music, you know, I'm going to be very excited.
Yeah, it's not going to take much to stir up fervor for those for that.
It's
you know,
I think it's the last film of our generation. It's the last big film of our when we grew up.
Yeah,
it's the last big of the blockbuster films that when we were kids. You know, this is it. This is the big one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is it going to be the same? I was talking with a friend of mine the other day. You know, we did this with Star Trek 10 years ago or whatever it was, and it kind of soured some of our feelings about Star Wars.
It did.
And so there's kind of this little feeling in the back of my mind. Is it possible that that will happen? Is it even conceivable that, of course, it's a different director. We're talking about Steven Spielberg, not George Lucas.
Yeah, the guy who's good with actors.
We're talking about a quality screenwriter.
We are talking about, but
Wait. Who's the screenwriter?
David Koepp.
Okay, I thought you were talking about George Lucas, because George Lucas, you know, I want to know what the Frank Darabont script was that he threw out.
They say there's a lot. They say there's a lot maintained in it.
Okay, that's what I'm talking. Okay, that's good. That's good. But the gentleman you did mention is a real screenwriter, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Not a bad director either, actually.
No, he's not.
I love the trigger effect.
Trigger effect.
You know, and Spielberg does about 5 cuts of the movie himself before he gives it to Lucas, and then Lucas collaborates with him on changes that he would make. Before they give it to the studio.
Yeah, I'd be skeptical of those changes after.
Spielberg has, I think he's probably by now finished his cuts of the movie, but when he was interviewed for this article, I think it was in Time or something,
Vanity Fair.
He said that he just looked at his third cut or something, and he said he's happy with it. He thinks he's completely happy with everything they shot.
He doesn't want to add anything, he doesn't want to subtract anything.
There'd be nothing he would change from the production of the film.
Yeah.
So, you know, you gotta. This is Spielberg talking.
Yeah, I, you know, I wouldn't. Are you gonna tell Spielberg, and especially about something like Indiana Jones? I feel sorry for the studio executive, and if it's Brad Gray, especially. Oh, I think you should do this. No, I'm not gonna tell this guy what to do. It's Indiana Jones.
Right.
You can't push him
around.
But the only one on this project who can possibly push him around, unfortunately, is George Lucas. You know,
faster, more intense.
Yeah. Well, because George Lucas, while it does have David Koepp screenwriting and, you know, the Frank Darabont screenplay behind it, too, Steven Spielberg's involved, the cast is there. George Lucas is the one that came up with the concept for the movie, and it's the same concept that he's been pushing and pushing and pushing for 20 years. They went into this in the Vanity Fair article.
Yeah.
And they finally got around and made, ultimately, the thing that the Spielberg and Harrison Ford did not want to make. So it's interesting that it did, you know, George Lucas stuck to his guns and was stubborn, like he famously is. And they did do it his way. So that makes me a little worried.
Chris, as much as I love the Star Wars films and you know, and have very mixed feelings about the newer ones, I feel the same way. I'm nervous.
And anyone who is crazy about Star Wars, please, and if you haven't checked it out yet, check out our show from last Sunday.
About fanboys.
About fanboys. We've got some big scoops on that one for you, and because that hasn't really hit the press lately, that this release is imminent, and we interview Chris Marquette, the star of the film, and the director Kyle Newman as well.
It was a great interview.
Yeah, and anyone that's interested in, it's completely off topic, the Kennedy assassination, of all things, you should listen to Wednesday night's show. We'd love some more listeners for that one, because that was a fantastic conversation about the Kennedy assassination and who Oswald was, just some great stuff. I'm pleased to announce that our show tonight is our highest rated live show ever in our 9-month history.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh,
so there
great.
You go. I'm not going to reveal the number.
No, don't reveal the numbers. Don't do it. Not on the air. Don't do it. No.
That's like the Colonel's secret recipe. I'm not doing that.
No, don't do it. The secret sauce, no.
But we sure appreciate everyone
listening. We do. Thank you.
Thank you so much for supporting Movie Geeks United. You guys, we consider you all our family, and we can't thank you enough for joining us. And Chris, man,
it's
great to have
pleasure.
Some breathing room and some conversation in tonight's show.
Yes, that's very fun, always.
Yeah, and Jerry, thanks for manning the chat room.
No problem. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to Chris, you, everyone.
Sorry about the guest not showing up tonight, but at least we got to hear about Cloverfield from Lizzie. And it was a tremendous amount of fun. So thanks, everyone, for joining us, and we will see you Wednesday night with a big show, possibly a two-hour show, featuring Brian Tyler, the composer of Rambo, and some other exciting guests. And we'll see you guys then.
Right. Good night.